This is the Elevate Podcast, where trial lawyers learn, share, and grow. Let's talk about how we can elevate our trial practices, law firms, and lives. And now, here are your hosts, coming to you from coast to coast, trial lawyers Ben Gideon and Rahul Ravipudi.
Today's episode of the Elevate Podcast is being brought to you by Smart Advocate. Smart Advocate is award-winning case management software used to manage personal injury, medical malpractice, MDL, class action law firms all over the United States. Great program, highly recommend it. Check them out at smartadvocate.com. Today's episode is being brought to you by Expert Institute. Expert Institute is the place to go for everything involving experts to help you win your case. Check them out at expertinstitute.com. And today's episode is being brought to you by Hype Legal. Hype Legal is a one-stop shop for all of your digital marketing needs. Check them out at hypelegal.com.
Welcome to the Elevate Podcast. I'm Rahul Ravipudi.
And I'm Ben Gideon.
Ben, how are you? I'm looking forward to seeing you at the PSBR Trial College next week.
Yeah, I'm really psyched. I'm flying out on Wednesday. So looking forward to getting out there and getting some cooler temps. It's been like in the 90s here in Maine. So heading out there to cool off.
Well, after the trial college, you're staying for a week and then you're going to be at the inner circle meetings with all of the bigwigs like yourself.
Yeah, that's the plan. You know, I'm a little worried about COVID. I know it's going around pretty rampant now, and but as long as we can avoid that, should be a great time. And then every year in August, I usually take a week and do something with my old high school friends. So we're heading out to Mammoth after that. We're going to spend a week hiking and doing stuff there. So I'm really, it's going to be like a California month in August. Looking forward to it. How's life with you?
Oh, everything's good. I was just at Grayson's Lottie Gras last weekend. Snoop Dogg, front row seats. Reverend Run performing, who was super entertaining, by the way. And then actually kind of learned a couple of things along the way, too. So it's great seeing a lot of great people out there. Grayson, how are you? Thanks for joining the podcast.
I'm doing great, guys. It's an honor to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me.
Oh, looking forward to seeing you next week, too.
Yeah, no, I'm looking forward to it, man. It's going to be a really good program. And, you know, down at the Ritz-Carlton, you know, we're all going to have some fun and hopefully learn a lot from you and your crew over there at PSD and R. Yeah, it should be really, really fun, man. Looking forward to it.
So let's take a couple of steps back. We want to learn a lot about you. I think the best place to start is, how did you become a trial lawyer?
Well, it's kind of a roundabout story. I grew up in a little town in Wyoming, and my dad was a criminal defense lawyer. And I'm the youngest of four boys. And we, you know, we grew up just kind of like being outdoors and all that good stuff. And I was never really very good at school. Well, I just never really, I think, dedicated myself to school. And so I never really had the plan to become a lawyer. And it just kind of, you know, over time, as my older brothers got their education and went out and kind of did their own thing, my dad kind of pressured me a little bit and said, hey, you know, you should think about being a lawyer, And I always kind of pushed it away. And when I got done with my undergrad in Montana, Montana State University, you know, I just wanted a change of scenery. So I moved out to San Diego, California, and just kind of started surfing and met a lot of people out there. Still with no plan really to go to graduate school or anything like that. And I kind of made my way back into the law in San Diego. I had a buddy who was an attorney, and he took me under his wing and really just kind of taught me everything about the law. And I was a law clerk, kind of a paralegal kind of crossover without any sort of paralegal certificate. And, you know, after about 3 or 4 years just working for him, I just said, you know what, let me get into law school, and sort of took that jump. And that was where I really sort of started dedicating myself to school. I said, you know, hey, these next 3 years are kind of the 3 years for the rest of your life. And I worked really, really hard in school and did very well in school. And then finally, kind of jumped on board with the Simon Law Group without really thinking about what it meant. And within the first week, they had me in my first trial. I kind of, you know, like I said, roundabout way, I worked a little bit for the district attorney down in San Diego. I tried a case for them, but it wasn't until I think I got it, you know, maybe a few or two or three trials in that I really found that I absolutely loved being a trial lawyer.
So how many trials have you had so far?
I think between the trials at the DA's office down in San Diego and all the civil cases I've done, I did two down in San Diego in juvenile, which were, you know, just bench trials. But I think since then I've had about 25. The first probably six or seven were, you know, second chair trials with, you know, Bob Simon, Tom Thayer, Sevi Fisher, and those guys.
Now, I just, through becoming friends with you over the years, just kind of looking at you, you look like a guy who actually is having fun through all aspects of trial. Lead up, during it, after it, teaching about it, getting appellate opinions that are really favorable to protect consumers. How do you keep it fun?
That's a good question, Rahul. You know, it didn't used to be like that. I think when I first started, and I think, you know, I don't know if you guys are the same way, but I was never really that into giving presentations. I was always really terrified to get in front of people. But as you continue on down this road and you get more comfortable in the courtroom and you kind of know where things should go and where you want things to go, it becomes more fun. And I think you have to make it that way. Otherwise, it's just going to be a miserable effort to get in there. And every time you're stressed out. And while I have stress, I think preparation is really key for me. And I really try to play things out in my mind. And then you can really be creative if you're completely prepared for a trial. And you can kind of just be creative and have fun stemming off of that. So I think that's one element of it, Rahul. And I think the other element is try cases with people that you really like and people that you know. You know, I haven't had the opportunity to try a case with you two gentlemen, but I tell you, pretty much every case I try, I pick somebody from my office and try it with. Or, you know, maybe I've got a guy who referred me the case who really wants to try it, and we go try it. I'll give you an example. This last case I tried was with a good friend from law school. And when he got out of law school, he started his own firm and referred this case over. And this was 4 years ago. Of course, these cases take a while to get to trial. And we were coming up to trial, and I kind of thought, you know, that the case would get tried. So I reached out to him and I said, "Hey, man, this case is going to go get tried. I know you've never tried a case before, but you want to go have some fun?" And he was into it. He was into it. And we both went out there and in Santa Monica for a couple of weeks and just had a really, really good time together. So you make your trials what you want to make of them. And we try to make them as fun as we can over here at Simon Law Group.
Do you have a particular case that when you reflect back on it is the one where you think, okay, I've just turned the corner now and I've really figured this out and I'm starting to have fun with it. And this is going to be something I'm going to be really good at and want to do for a living.
Man, going back a few years, in 2016, we got a case that came into our office and it was, you know, it was only about 2 or 3 weeks before trial. And the referring attorney wanted the plaintiff to settle for, you know, just about the amount of his medical expenses. And we took the case over. Bob was actually supposed to go try it, but he was in trial. So he goes, "Hey, Grayson, you know, run up to Ventura, go try this case." And I was like, I never tried a first chair case. So I asked Sevi to come up there with me. And it was my first chair case. And it ended up being a really good verdict, you know, $3.7 million on a cervical fusion case. And this is the one that Rahul was talking about that eventually went and got published. I think just from that experience of really getting the opportunity to just kind of spread my wings and game plan the trial how I wanted to, pick the themes the themes that I thought were going to be applicable, and really just going through the entire trial and taking a ton of witnesses and then closing and getting a verdict. I think just that experience gave me a lot of confidence. And while it wasn't that point where I really turned the corner, I think just having that confidence to go into my next case and be able to game plan it the same way or the way that I thought was necessary. I think that was really an eye opener for me. It was just such a good experience. That's the Pebley versus Santa Clara Organics case here in California that everybody's so familiar with.
And what was the appellate issue?
The appellate issue was before the Pebley case, insurance companies were really trying to take this Howell case on medical expenses and say that if a plaintiff doesn't treat through their own health insurance and instead treats on a lien, then they fail to mitigate their damages. And they're really trying to, you know, shoehole plaintiffs into treating through their own health insurance. So we had that case. Our guy had Kaiser health insurance and he decided he didn't want to use it and had surgery, his next surgery outside of Kaiser on a lien. So the appellate court said that the plaintiff has the ultimate decision because they're the victim and they have the ultimate decision to choose who they want to treat with, particularly for, you know, these big injuries when you have somebody who's going to need a surgery that that could paralyze them. And so that holding is really started to be used in pretty much every single personal injury case that we have, which is just, you know, it's just overwhelming. I honestly never thought that we would be in this position. I honestly never thought so. It's super overwhelming, but just been a really, really good experience to go through all of that.
So looking at these cases that you've tried over the years, whether it's a particular type of case, let's just say a spine case or any other type of case you've done, wrongful deaths, how have you evolved over time? And do things seem simpler to you? And are you able to hear a fact pattern and immediately your mind goes to, here's how it theme out that case?
It's just like with everything, you know, the experience is so invaluable just being in court and trying cases against really good attorneys. I've found that as time has gone on, I'll come in on a case and maybe on the defense, they've got in-house counsel over at State Farm. Typically, the second we come in, that gets sent out to outside counsel, somebody who's really, really experienced. And so you get to really go up against some of the best attorneys in the game. And with every single case, it's almost like you're playing Dungeons and Dragons with your bros and you're going in and you're fighting some big monster. You get experience points. I mean, and you learn these little tricks here and there that the folks on the defense do, and you kind of adopt them as your own. So I do, you know, now after, I think after trying 25 cases, really, if a case comes into our office or I've got a case that, hey, you know, this one's going to have to get tried in a couple of weeks. As long as I know the facts and I you know, I don't have anything hidden from me, it's pretty easy for me to foresee this is how this case needs to be tried. Here's the things that need to be done and to be able to just game plan it. And I don't know about you, Rahul, but, you know, I try to game plan my trials, really my cases from trial backwards, right? So no matter where I get it, I go to the end of trial and I think, okay, who are the witnesses the defense are going to call? Who are the witnesses we're going to call? And how do we win this case? And I start to plan it that way. If we're still in discovery, I start taking depos. If we're in expert discovery, I start taking, you know, treating physician depos. But it has gotten easier over time just with experience and just going up against, you know, some of the best guys in the game.
You must encounter some of the standard defenses that you see over and over again or approaches, as you've alluded to. Do you have tips on how to confront those?
Yeah, Ben, that's a good question. You know, I think the standard defense in every case is that the plaintiff is a liar. And when I started trying cases, you know, I read like Polarizing the Case by Rick Friedman. And so I would always try to push the defense into that corner where they've got to say the plaintiff is a liar. Over time, it's turned where the defense attorneys don't want to do that. They're like, hey, I don't want to be saying that the plaintiff is a liar. And so they go down these other routes. You know, talking about degeneration, talking about plaintiffs being overweight, talking about other incidents occurring that might have caused the injuries. I think one of the overarching defenses in our case, aside from the plaintiff is a liar, is really that degeneration argument. And in order to combat that, I really just make it our best friend. It's kind of one of those things, you make every fact a good fact for you, or you try to flip it on its head so that it is a good fact for you. When I take treating physician depositions, defense expert depositions, bring up the generation. You know, we all have it. You can be asymptomatic with the generation, and you can be asymptomatic with the generation, get in a car crash, and that triggers the symptoms. Knowing the Casey Jury instructions and kind of using your questions to go along those Casey Jury instructions so that when it comes time to close, you can refer back to those with the jury and win your case that way. I think we've won a lot of cases just based on aggravation of pre-existing condition arguments. There's a lot of them, Ben. You know, there's a ton of these defenses out there, and I think we've got some tips on every single one. And you know, if there's anything specific you wanted to talk about, you know, particularly the plaintiff lying thing is big. Yeah, I think there's arguments for all of them.
Yeah, I mean, one thing you notice about defense lawyers, they do seem to do kind of a paint by number approach. Sometimes it's not even clear they're trying your case, but they still have the same arguments, which is helpful to us, I think, because we can generally anticipate what they're going to do. Are there particular people, though, that you... I know on the plaintiff's side, the defense knows who the lawyers are like you. I'm sure when you get into a case, they're now transferring it to somebody else to defend it. Are there people when you see them that you worry, okay, this person could be a game changer because they bring something unique into the courtroom and I've got to up my game?
Yeah, for sure. I think there are a few folks that I'll see that when they come on these cases, I might kind of groan or give a big sigh, like, oh, I got to deal with this dude again. I tried a case against Dana Fox a couple years ago, and it was a really, really bad case for me. But I was pretty excited with the outcome. And again, you know, I just got a ton of experience going against him. I tried a case against Bob Reisinger, also a good trial attorney. I read a Jerry Spence book. I love Jerry Spence. You know, he's kind of one of my idols. And I model a lot of my stuff after Jerry. But I read Jerry Spence book about how to argue and win every time. And in the book, there's a really good explanation about other attorneys and attorneys that you're going up against. And you're always going to have that fear going into the courtroom, right? You're always going to have that fear going into the courtroom. But if you see another attorney come in and you're all of a sudden scared of them, you know, there's a reason for that. And it's the reason is because you're giving them power. Right. You know, just by their reputation or by their name, you attribute some sort of holy aura to them. And if you don't give them that, then you're not going to have that fear. And I think that you really control your perception of other people. And so if somebody comes into a trial like Dana Fox or, you know, maybe Bob Reisinger or something like that, I try not to let them be bigger than they really are. I try not to give them so much credibility where I'm scared of them. Because I realize at the end of the day, look, they're just a person and they're dealing with the same facts that I am in this case. And, you know, we're typically going to be on the right side of justice. So I think that gives me confidence in going up against some of these folks.
When you say you modeled your style after Jerry Spence, can you describe what elements you think you've taken from him? I mean, try your case and win every time or something. I do recall reading that many years ago, and all of his stuff really is great. But then you come away, or part of me came away thinking, one of the takeaways is that he's Jerry Spence and I'm not. So I'm curious about your approach to modeling yourself after him, just given his kind of uniqueness and the legend of it.
Yeah, well, you know, he is a legend, man. I mean, he's I think, widely regarded as one of the best trial lawyers of all time. And as trial lawyers, I don't know how you guys feel, but, you know, I feel like I'm little bits and pieces of these folks that I watch that I really, really like. You know, like Mitnick, I absolutely love his stuff. You know, Spence, I love his stuff. All Keenan, you know, all these guys, I kind of take a piece of everything that they do. But specifically with Spence, I really just love his approach to trials as honesty. Just being completely honest with yourself about what the case is, and then telling the jury about the case and being completely open, honest, humble, not hiding anything. I think one of the biggest things that I've learned about juries over the years is that they just hate it when people lie. They hate it when people try to hide stuff, or when it looks like they're trying to hide stuff. And so I try to have honest conversations with myself before trial, and I try to take those honest conversations with myself and give them to the jury, whether it's through the witnesses or whether it's in closing arguments. And if I make a mistake in trial, I'll own up to it. If I say something that's incorrect, I'll bring it up in closing and I'll apologize for it. I think just having that, you know, that honesty in there has given me confidence as well. Because if you don't have to hide anything and you just tell your story, it, you know, it's just such an easier process in the courtroom to go through. And I think the juries really appreciate that.
And that's part of your embracing some of the what defense facts or bad facts, as they like to call them, and making them your own.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, there's something to be said for, you know, motions in limine and fighting these facts. Obviously, you're not going to take a case and be like, oh, there's all these irrelevant, terrible facts out there. Let me just embrace them and I'll just tell the jury about, you know, how my plaintiff was expelled from high school. There's a process at the beginning of trial where obviously, you know, you're going to file motions in limine, try to exclude some of this stuff. But once you know things are coming in, yeah, embrace them. Absolutely. Embrace them. Make them your best facts and just tell the jury before the defense does. Because if the defense gets it out, then you're in trouble.
What's your approach to jury selection? Raul's approach over the time on the podcast. I'm just curious how you approach it.
Ben, I think that jury selection is my favorite part of trial. I really, really, really like jury selection. You know, I always do a mini opening. I always try to get my bad facts out there. And again, it just kind of goes along with that whole honesty theme. I tell them in mini opening, look, I'm here to be honest with you. And here's all the facts I think that you need to consider when you're considering being a juror on this case. And I'm kind of like I don't like to talk that much in jury selection. I think I'm good at getting jurors to talk. I try to kind of have a balance of, you know, maybe 20-25% is me asking questions, and then 75-80% is the jury talking. And I want it to kind of be a town hall meeting. You know, I want people to feel comfortable to just speak up. And how many of us agree with this? People talk and they say, hey, I agree with it. And I think by having that just sort of openness and making it really okay to have biases and to be on one side versus the other, I think it helps jurors be honest in there. I really do. And so that's my goal. I don't go into jury selection with the goal of preconditioning. I think some lawyers do that, and that's okay. You know, everybody's got their own style. But I think my ultimate goal is just to really dig in and find bias on these cases. And if something comes up where some preconditioning might be a little bit appropriate, then I might take advantage of that. You know, I'll give you an example. If I'm talking about car wrecks and one of our jurors has been in a car wreck, and in mini opening, I said, hey, you know, this is a 9-mile-an-hour rear end collision. So it's a minor impact collision, according to the defense. I might have a juror that says something to the effect of, look, I was in a rear end collision and there was no damage to my car, but I hurt my neck and I hurt my back and my neck still hurts. You know, I might ask that juror, because of that, or are you kind of, you know, associating with the plaintiff a little bit more, leaning our way? Maybe they'll say, yeah. And then I'll say something to the effect of like, well, so you know from your own personal experience that you can be hurt in a collision that doesn't damage your car. Yeah. And so if somebody comes in here from the defense and takes the stand and says you can't, what will your thoughts be? And they'll say, well, I know they're full of shit. So you can kind of take advantage of some of those situations. But I think my overall goal is really to just talk to people, get to know people, try to figure out what makes them tick. And typically, if you get to know somebody and you go a few layers down, you're going to be able to decide, hey, this is going to be a good juror for me, or this is going to be a bad juror for me. And then you can exercise your peremptories thoughtfully.
Do you ever, through that process and your methodology for voir dire, are you uncovering and revealing some of the jurors who you think would be more favorable to the plaintiff versus the defense?
Yeah. And I think that happens with a good voir dire. I think that if you you know, I'm not sure what your lead in is, what you guys do, but I do sort of a little bit of a spin-off on what Mitnick does. You know, I think that we all use a lot of Mitnick in jury selection, which is his books are super, super helpful. But if you're getting folks to open up and tell you a little bit about how they feel about these cases and, you know, back injuries or whatever you're dealing with, you're going to naturally have that. And I think, you know, from a plaintiff's perspective, it's just my experience that the folks who are initially leaning towards the plaintiff are going to be a little bit more honest in there. And they usually speak up first. And they might say, well, look, I've got a sister who's got a back injury and I've seen it firsthand and how it affects our whole family. So I just don't think I could be fair. I think it's a good opportunity for an attorney who's doing voir dire to get a lot of credibility there. Because if somebody says that, you know, you all of a sudden go and you try to rehabilitate them. You know, some of the jurors might be like, all right, this guy's kind of talking out of both sides of his mouth. But if you go in there and you're honest with them and you want them to be honest with you, and they say that they just can't be fair to the defendant, I think that's okay. I think that's okay. And you thank them and you say, hey, this is what we're doing here. And that takes a lot of courage for you to say that in front of everybody. And I appreciate you saying it. So absolutely. Every single time you do voir dire, you're going to find somebody who is not going to be fair to the defense. And that's okay. I think that's an important thing to acknowledge.
We'd like to thank the sponsors of the Elevate podcast, Steno, National Court Reporting Service that allows trial lawyers to defer the costs of court reporting until the end of the case. Take a look, steno.com. And by Law Pods. Law Pods is the podcast production company that we use to produce the show that produces podcasts for lawyers all over the country. They have an expertise in podcasting and the law. Check them out at lawpods.com. Just to switch over for a moment to the personal life, I understand you have a new child, so congratulations on that. And how many does that make?
I'm just getting started, bro. This is our first, and Rahul, you got three, right?
I do.
You got three. Ben, where are you at?
I'm at three, but mine are older.
Well, so it just so happens that all my friends have three kids and everybody's sort of wrapping up while we're just getting started. Yeah, we're super excited, man. It's
And your wife's a lawyer too?
Yeah, she is.
So how are you going to keep up your rapid trial pace with brand new child and a attorney wife?
That's a really good question. It's been pretty good so far. You know, I tried my last case in late May, and I had another one going to trial. And I just told the partners over here at SLG, I said, look, you know, I'm not going to be in trial when my baby comes. So, you know, they've given me quite a bit of time. I think my next case is September 2nd. So I still got some time, but once things fire back up again, it's going to be tough. It's going to be tough to leave this little girl at home because she's just, you know, all the things, you know, correct me if I'm wrong, guys, but all the things they say about having kids is absolutely true. You know, you fall in love the moment you first see them. And that's exactly what happened, man. This little girl came out, I was just absolutely in love. She's got me wrapped around her finger for sure.
It won't change. My little girl's 14 now and I'm still wrapped around her finger at that age, but no, it's great. Congratulations about that. And on the lifestyle issue, I happen to see on your bio that you are a vegan. Is that correct?
That's true. Yeah, 4 years now.
So I was wondering if, I was telling Raul before we went on, I was watching an interview with Novak Djokovic, who was talking about his vegan lifestyle and how that kind of was a turning point in his tennis career, because he had a lot of, apparently it never showed, but he had a lot of anxiety on the court and also kind of allergies that caused him difficulty breathing apparently in his matches. And this whole like conversion to veganism, I think, helped him on both of those fronts. So I was just curious whether there's a connection between your lifestyle choices and your career in any way.
I think at one point, and you guys have been through this too, you know, we when we start as attorneys, there's so much grinding that goes on. I mean, your first 5 years, I just felt like I was grinding so, so hard. And I thought it was unhealthy for me. And between my wife and I, we just made a decision one day to just do a month. You know, it was like a New Year's resolution, like, hey, let's get healthy. I think we had seen this documentary Game Changers. Have you guys seen that?
No.
No.
It's really, really good. And it's about this ultimate fighter guy who gets injured, and then he does a bunch of research and he decides to go vegan after all the research he did. And what he found was the Roman gladiators, who were just the biggest badasses of their time, they found like this gladiator cemetery, right? And they dug up these bones, and the gladiator bones and their build was so much stronger than the people around them. And they dug back deeper, and they looked at a lot of literature from that area. And it turns out that the Roman gladiators were mostly vegetarian, and a lot were vegan. And so he does this study and goes through veganism and finds that it's really, really beneficial for you. And so I think that month that we decided to take was really just for personal growth and trying to be healthy. But once we got through that month, we just said, you know, this is great. It feels great. And we've stuck with it ever since. So like I said, it's been 4 years and it's been an experience. You know, it makes it difficult to go out to dinner with your friends sometimes, or go have dinner over at your friend's house. But it's been great. It's been great. And I highly recommend it to anybody who wants to get a little bit healthier.
So give us like a daily menu. What would you eat on a typical day?
Well, I'll give you my trial diet because it doesn't change. I'm kind of a creature of habit, particularly when it comes to trial. So I get up in the morning, I'll have my coffee, throw some almond milk in there. Every day during trial, I have a piece of sourdough toast with avocado on it. And then I'll throw tomatoes and cucumbers on it. And that's my whole breakfast. And then I make a peanut butter and jelly with banana sandwich for lunch with other little snacks, maybe nuts or things like that. And then for dinner, you know, I usually come home and have whatever I want. We have a meal prep plan. It's called Purple Carrot. So it ranges from, you know, everything from like a vegan curry or chicken masala to they've got like vegan tuna fish sandwiches, spaghetti, all that good stuff. So there's a ton of stuff out there. And it's taken a while to kind of get familiar with the whole every product that's vegan. But that's kind of my diet as I go through trial. And I usually get really, as you might imagine, I get really cut during trial because I just don't eat that much.
Well, now you've disclosed all your secrets. I think that's going to be dangerous for you. But that's great, actually. It's nice to hear that. I've found that having some habits involving your diet and clothes and all that surrounding trial is great because it just takes away decisions. And when you're in that moment, you want to have fewer decisions about what you're doing. You like just simplify everything else that's not the trial.
Exactly. I mean, particularly because like, I don't know about you guys, but if I'm a trial, I'm like, you know, my body's here. My mind's like 1,000 miles away thinking about things that are going to happen the next day.
Raul, are you going to do it?
Do veganism?
Yeah. Make the commitment really right here, right now.
Yeah.
No pressure. No pressure, brother.
And I appreciate that. I feel pressure right now. I don't know why, but the answer is going to be probably not, but it's an aspiration. Sometime, somewhere, I will turn into a vegan. I can feel it. But I love honey. Does honey not count? You're not allowed to have that?
You're not allowed to have it. No, you're not allowed to have it. You know, I think the thrust behind being vegan is not taking advantage of animals or any sort of animal products. And with honey, you know, you have bees that are really making the honey, and then you kind of just steal it from them. But I don't eat honey, but I know that there are it kind of like with everything, there's like little offshoots of veganism. So I think the more extreme vegans don't eat honey, but some, you know, some do. And
well, let's just slide on the honey, Rahul.
All right. Then I think I might be it.
And maple syrup's a good substitute anyway.
That just doesn't seem healthy. But okay. So if I can have the offshoot of honey, chicken, beef, and fish, I am in.
Okay. Yeah. I don't know if that's going to work for you.
Okay. All right. We'll fine tune this. We'll fine tune this over time. Bob Simon, I was with him this weekend at your Lottie Gras, and he asked a question to Panish, me, and a few others. And he said, what's your trial superstitions? Something unusual that you do every single time when you're in trial, for whether it's an unusual reason or it's tradition. So what's one of yours, Grayson?
I never talk about what the verdict might be. That's my only really superstition. I'm not a superstitious guy. I know a lot of trial lawyers are. I'm just not very superstitious, but maybe before trial, I'll talk about value. But as soon as I get into trial, I don't say anything about what the verdict may or may not be. I just think it's bad luck. I just think I'm going to jinx myself. The only case I've ever been defensed on, I did that. And I'm pretty sure it's because I did that. I pontificated on the verdict. So don't pontificate on the verdict. And out of curiosity, Rahul, what was yours?
So I'm like you. I'm not incredibly superstitious, but I, for some weird reason, developed this tradition, and I'm sharing too much right now. And I shared too much this weekend, so I'll do it again. When I was a law clerk over at Green, Broillet, Taylor, Wheeler, and Panish way back when I was in law school, I worked with a legal assistant. Her name's Sherry Dempsey, and she was the legal assistant to Brown Green. And when I left that firm and got my first job, Sherry gave me a going away present, which were a pair of boxers that say Pootie's Booty on the back. And so the first day of every trial since then, it's been 23 years. That's what I wear. And I'm telling you, they're not in a condition to be worn anymore. So, you know, I need safety pins and all sorts of stuff, but I think that's more for fun than it is that I think that's somehow a good luck charm or anything like that.
Yeah, 23 years with the same underwear.
Whoa. When you phrase it that way.
Bro, that's awesome. I love that.
Ben, yeah, that's a good one, especially since you're not superstitious. Mine is similar in a way because it involves clothes. I haven't worn a suit in a courtroom during a trial in at least a decade. I got it in my mind way back. Maybe it's because I'm in a rural, poor state in northern New England, but folks here, they're not accustomed to seeing people wearing suits. So I will wear a sport coat and a tie, and I always want to look professional, but I do not wear suits. I'm thinking about changing course on that one, just because I think as the world progresses, the suit isn't as off-putting as it maybe once was in certain places, but that's mine. I have one of those sport coats with the blue blazer that you literally can't distinguish me from the courtroom deputy. And I always thought if I dressed and looked like the court deputy and the jury couldn't tell me apart, that was probably a pretty good thing.
Man of the people. That's good. That goes back to the trust factor, man. You know, you want to be, you want to look like one of the jurors. You want to be one of them and create a tribe. So I really like that. That's a good superstition to have.
What's the flashiest thing you've worn in trial, Grayson?
Dude, I'm so not flashy. I the flashiest thing I've worn in trial is probably like a flashy blue tie. I grew up in the middle of nowhere, dude. And like, my first few suits, and actually kind of funny story, the first case I tried with Bob Simon, I didn't have a suit that fit me. I think my only suit in the closet was something that I got for my grandpa's funeral when I was in college. And it was this big boxy thing. And I was wearing red ties every day because that's all I had. But no, I'm just not a flashy guy. I don't have flashy shoes. I got old ass shoes. I got some very, very humble suits that I wear. You know, I always wear this old brown suit that's kind of a good luck charm on jury selection. But if I'm really digging down and thinking about it, I think I wore a watch one time in trial. So that's probably the flashiest thing I've ever worn.
Is that a conscious decision or in kind of thinking, hey, you're young or you're going into certain venues and you don't want to wear something flashy, or is it a lifestyle decision?
I think it's a little bit of both. For me, it's just comfortable. You know, I want to be comfortable and I want to be myself, and I'm just not a flashy guy. But at the same time, I love this practice because it's always about learning. You know, you're always learning new things. And, you know, as you go to these conferences, there's folks that are flashy and they go, never wear your flashy stuff in trial, or, you know, always wear earth tones early in the case, and then you can get more bold as the case goes on. So I think there's a certain psychology to it. But for me, mostly it's just my personal comfort. Just being comfortable is super important to me.
Boy, we've covered a lot of ground today between diet and clothing. I think we've got it covered.
No, this was awesome. Grayson, thanks for joining us. I really appreciate it.
Yeah, thank you so much for doing this. And I look forward to meeting you in person next week.
Yeah, same here, Ben. Look forward to it. I thank you guys so much for the invite. You know, this has been a blast, and good to get to know you guys a little bit more. And Ben, hopefully we can get to know each other a little bit more next week.
Sounds great. Well, thanks again. Good seeing you, Raul.
Good seeing you too, Ben.
For more information about today's guests and the topics discussed on the show, please visit our website at www.elevate.net. That's ELAWBATE.net, where you'll find guest profiles and show notes, and you can continue the conversation by joining our Facebook group. And if you enjoyed today's show, we hope that you'll subscribe and consider giving us a 5-star review. So for now, keep on working to elevate your trial law practice, and we'll see you back again soon.